At 12:29 p.m. Central Standard Time, the sleek black limousine containing President Kennedy, his wife Jacqueline, Governor John Connally, his wife Nellie, and two Secret Service agents turned right onto Houston Street from Main Street. Directly in front of them loomed the Texas School Book Depository Building, with Lee Harvey Oswald in the sixth-floor window at the southeast corner of the building. For the first time, Oswald could see President Kennedy, and along the entire block from Main to Elm, Kennedy was within Oswald's theoretical gun sight. But of course, Oswald could not take a shot at Kennedy while he was moving closer and closer to Oswald's position, because directly behind the president and the president's car was the car containing a battery of Secret Service agents who were supposed to be scanning the buildings in front of them. Oswald did not want to be seen either by the Secret Service agents or by the spectators on the ground directly below him. His window was only half open in order to conceal the fact that there was somebody behind the window watching the motorcade. So at 12:29 p.m., Oswald must have stepped back from the window so as not to be seen by anyone on the outside. There was a cameraman at the corner of Main and Houston Street, one block south of the depository building. And that cameraman, Robert Hughes, had his movie camera trained on the presidential vehicle as it moved down the Houston block towards the depository building. The southeast corner window on the sixth floor was within Hughes's camera sight, and the window is visible for more than 10 seconds as the presidential vehicle approached Elm Street. There is no visible sign of a human being in that window. Again, Oswald was probably standing back, but a sophisticated technological analysis of the film in the early 2000s revealed that there was a human being in the window, and the human being was in motion. Beyond that, we could see nothing to identify the human being as Oswald. But we know that Oswald was there because seconds later, a figure that looked just like Oswald was identified by two individuals directly below the window on the ground. When the clock turned to 12:30, Oswald was waiting. The presidential vehicle turned slowly to the left, making a hard left turn onto Elm Street. At that point, it was almost directly below the window where Oswald was waiting. According to witnesses, when the car straightened out, a gunshot was heard. Of course, this was a time of confusion. Given that it was the first shot, many people thought it was something other than a gunshot. Perhaps a traffic motorcyclist backfire, perhaps a tire that had blown out, perhaps a firecracker that had been thrown. Even the Secret Service agents weren't sure if it was a gunshot. Their first reaction was that it was a gunshot because they were familiar with the noise of high-powered rifles. But when they looked at the president, he showed no sign of being disturbed in any way. He had obviously not been hit by a gunshot at that point. And so the Secret Service agents, some of them, were actually looking at each other and trying to get confirmation as to whether this was indeed a shot or not. By the time they had a chance to look back at the president, a second shot was fired, and there was no doubt this time that it was a shot. The second shot penetrated JFK's neck, exited his throat, and hit Governor John Connally seated in the indented jump seat forward of JFK's position, that is, in front of JFK, but indented unlike JFK, whose seat was adjacent to the right side of the car. Given that Oswald's rifle and shot was on a diagonal trajectory from the sixth-floor window to the car, through the president's neck and through John Connally, who was seated directly to the left of the president, but in front of the president, the shot could only have hit Connally once it exited JFK's neck. Now, it's important to go back a second and to point out that Oswald must have been in a standing position when he fired the first shot. That's because the only way he could get off a shot was to aim down and through the very narrow half opening in the window, and he had to stand back so he would not be seen by the Secret Service. Oswald knew that he had to shoot fast, because within a few seconds, his view would be blocked by an oak tree that blocked a portion of Elm Street behind which the presidential vehicle would have to pass. So Oswald may have hurried his shot. His nervousness must have been at a peak because this was his do-or-die moment. This was the first shot, and he could always terminate his plan up until that second, but no longer. Oswald fired, and whether his shot was deflected by a traffic masthead or simply went awry because of Oswald's extreme nervousness will never be known. But the shot hit a curb and ricocheted across the grassy area between Elm Street and Main Street and hit a curb near where James Tagg was standing, directly below the railroad trestle at the Triple Underpass. Tagg was nicked in the cheek by the concrete that ricocheted off the shot that hit the curb. He was one of the victims of the shooting, along with John Connally and John F. Kennedy. Immediately after the first shot, Oswald crouched into position. He had organized the boxes so that the rifle could sit upon the boxes as it was pointed downrange, and the presidential vehicle, after the second shot, was moving very, very slowly because the driver looked back to see what was going on in the back seat. There was a great deal of pandemonium. John Connally himself said, "My God, they're going to kill us all." Connally had recognized the first shot as a shot and had tried to turn to his right and then to his left to see if the president was injured. Before he had a chance to see, he was struck by the second bullet. He heard the first shot, which told him that he was not hit by that shot, because gunshot victims do not, as a rule, hear the shots that hit them. But Connally heard the first shot. He did not hear the second, indicating that the second shot hit him. But if Connally had been able to turn around before the second shot that hit him, he would have seen President Kennedy waving to the crowd, because Kennedy was not hit by the first shot either. Remember, the first shot missed. But Oswald's second shot wounded both men. At the time of the second shot, the presidential vehicle had emerged from the oak tree that blocked Oswald's view. Oswald was comfortably seated, and his target was becoming smaller and smaller in relation to Oswald's position as it was moving away from Oswald. But it was moving very, very slowly, so it was a very easy shot, both the second shot and especially the third shot, when the vehicle had almost come to a halt as the driver was turning around to see what was going on in the back seat. Oswald's third shot was the fatal headshot at frame 313 of the Zapruder film. The assassination had been completed. However, it's important to note that the assassination began before Abraham Zapruder restarted his camera in making the sensational movie film, the most famous home movie ever recorded. Zapruder had started filming the motorcade before the presidential vehicle rounded the corner of Houston onto Elm. But all he saw were motorcyclists who were preceding the presidential vehicle. It was clear that the presidential vehicle was some time distant, and Zapruder did not know how much movie film he had remaining in his camera. So Zapruder stopped the camera, and by the time he started it again, the presidential vehicle was already some distance down Elm Street and had long since straightened out. So it is clear that at the time of the first shot, the Zapruder film had not yet restarted. This is important because the Zapruder film has been regarded and always has been regarded as a time clock of the assassination. The frames passed through Zapruder's camera at 18 frames per second. And so by noticing the reaction times of the president and John Connally, it was possible to estimate the amount of time that lapsed between shots. However, since the Zapruder film did not restart until after the first shot, this meant that Oswald had more time to get off three shots than was originally thought to be the case by the FBI and the Warren Commission. The FBI and the Warren Commission made the superficial decision that Zapruder must have captured the entire assassination sequence because at the beginning of the Zapruder film, JFK is seen happily waving to the crowd. There was always an assumption that the first shot must have hit Kennedy because he was closest to Oswald of all three shots. Given that logical inference or conclusion, the theory was that Zapruder captured the entire assassination. But if Oswald's first shot had killed Kennedy, then Zapruder would not have captured the assassination at all because it would have been in the past by the time he restarted his camera. Instead, of course, Kennedy had not yet been wounded, but the assassination sequence had begun and now has been estimated by journalist Max Holland and by other historians to be at least 10 seconds and probably slightly more than 11 seconds. Remember, the shooting sequence time begins with the first shot. So however many seconds ensued thereafter, two shots took place within that time, the second shot and the third shot. That meant that Oswald had at least 10 seconds and possibly 11 to fire off two shots, easily enough time for one person to work the bolt, which was estimated to take 2.5 seconds per shot, and fire off those two shots. This is critical because it means that Oswald did not have to be a premier marksman to carry off the assassination. 11 seconds or even 10 was plenty of time to fire two shots after the sequence began that ended up killing the president. Two cartridges were found adjacent to the window on the sixth floor, and one cartridge was found adjacent to the boxes that surrounded the window. This suggests that when Oswald was standing at the time of the first shot, the cartridge snapped out of the gun, hit the side of the window, and then rolled to the box. Whereas when he was crouching by the window, with the rifle resting on the window edge, the cartridges hit the boxes and then rolled back to the window. Oswald seems not to have disarranged the cartridges or bothered to retrieve them, nor did he bother to retrieve the paper bag which he had held in his hands when he left Fraser that morning. The paper bag was found in the sixth floor window area along with the cartridges. Time was of the essence for Oswald. While the shooting was taking place, Bonnie Ray Williams, Harold Norman, and Junior Jarman were just a few feet below Oswald on the fifth floor. They could hear the bolt being worked on the rifle. Harold Norman could hear three clicks and three shots. And Norman also noticed that the concrete from the top of the floor was falling onto the heads of his friends as the shooting was taking place. Norman said at the time he was positive the shots came from directly above him. Now, there was much speculation that this could not possibly have happened, that Norman could hear the working of the bolt and hear the shells hitting the floor above him. But in fact, the Warren Commission, in April of 1964, reenacted the clicking of the bolt with Oswald's own rifle, and it was found that those who stood on the fifth floor could clearly hear the bolt action, could hear the shells hitting the floor, and indeed even the plaster coming off the top of the walls. So this reenactment proved that Norman was correct. Time was now of the essence for Oswald. He snaked his way through the boxes and began walking rapidly to the opposite part of the floor. He was on the southeast side. He needed to get to the northwest side, where there was the only stairwell to walk down to the bottom. If Oswald could get down to the first floor, he could exit out the back door. But if he couldn't, he would have to get off at the second floor and walk again across the entire range of floor to the southeast side of the second floor, where there was a stairwell down to the first floor and the first floor exit, which, as you can tell from any picture of the depository building, was on the eastern side of the building. Oswald, therefore, was moving quickly. When he got near to the northwest corner of the sixth floor, he wedged his rifle between a series of boxes, near which also contained his empty clipboard, which he had filled no orders in that morning. Oswald also had stuffed his jacket in a different location on the sixth floor. But Oswald then proceeded to go down the stairway. He walked quickly, and of course he would not be winded in any way, because he was 24 years old, and he was walking downhill. When he approached the second floor, he could hear two men hurriedly trying to walk up to the second floor from the main floor. These two men were Roy Truly, the business manager, and Marion Baker, a police officer who had heard the shots and had been approaching the Texas School Book Depository as he rode his motorcycle near the end of the motorcade. Baker stopped at the book depository, jumped off his motorcycle, dashed into the building, and quickly met Truly. They tried to go up an elevator, but that was jammed, so they immediately went to the western steps, down which Oswald was headed. When they got up to the second floor landing, Baker saw through the window Oswald moving quickly in a direction which would take him out of sight of Baker's field of vision. Truly by then was already trying to get to the third floor, but Baker ran through the door with the window that showed Oswald moving away from him and ordered Oswald to stop. Of course, Baker did not know who this man was, did not know his name, and he held his gun on him and asked Truly, who had returned to this position, and Truly verified that this was a man who worked in the building, Lee Harvey Oswald. Baker had thought that the gunshots came from the top of the building, so he and Truly immediately turned, left Oswald alone, and dashed up the remaining steps to the top floor. Oswald by now was alone. Curiously, he had not shown any sign of recognition or any curiosity that this policeman was holding a gun on him. He didn't ask what the meaning of this was. He didn't seem startled. He seemed very calm, not bothered in the slightest. Despite this odd reaction, Oswald was now alone, and he dug into his pocket, withdrew the dime he had used to assemble the rifle, and he purchased a Coke to provide himself an alibi. Hopefully people would think, if they saw him with the Coke, that he was drinking a Coke at the time of the assassination. At the time that Baker and Truly confronted Oswald, it had been some 75 or 76 seconds since the assassination. Baker's route was reenacted by the Warren Commission, and once again, it was found that it took about 75 seconds to get from Baker's position outside the building to the position where he confronted Oswald. Also, agents tried to reenact what they thought was Oswald's movements, and they found that Oswald's movements also took him to the second floor lunchroom area in 75 seconds or so. So it was obvious that it was reasonably possible for Oswald to have committed the assassination, but to be no farther than the second floor following the assassination. Oswald proceeded to walk through the second floor business offices, where he was confronted by Mrs. J.A. Reed, who had just come back inside the building following the assassination. Mrs. Reed knew that the president had been fired at, but she did not know if he was hit or not. She told Oswald that the president had been the victim of an assassination attempt, but maybe they didn't hit him, she said. Oswald said absolutely nothing in reply, but mumbled something and kept walking. He walked to the farthest southeast corner of the second floor, where the steps leading down to the first floor were located. He went down to the first floor, exited the building, 3 minutes after the assassination and 2 minutes before the building was sealed. Oswald was inordinately lucky because by the time he made it to the second floor and was stopped by Baker, the rear exit was being sealed, so that by going to the front exit, Oswald was going to the last exit that had not yet been sealed, but which would be sealed 2 minutes after he left. Oswald then crossed Houston Street and began walking along Elm in an easterly direction, trying to get a bus that would take him back to Oak Cliff. Finally, there was a bus that was stopped in traffic, but moving in the direction he wanted and was slated to go to Oak Cliff. So Oswald banged on the back door and the bus driver opened it up so he could board. And incredibly, Oswald was recognized on the bus by Mary Bledsoe, his landlady from the previous month, who had ordered Oswald out of the house in early October. Mrs. Bledsoe did not like Oswald, but she recognized him and she tried to hide her face so he would not see her. There's no evidence that he did see her. But according to the testimony of Mrs. Bledsoe, Oswald looked like a maniac. His shirt tail was out, he was sweating, and he looked like he was in a state of terror. Evidently, the calm Oswald of the second floor lunchroom had changed in the minutes since to the maniacal face that Mrs. Bledsoe saw on the bus headed towards Oak Cliff. But because the bus was stuck in traffic, one passenger asked for a transfer and got off. This must have given Oswald the same idea, because he asked for a transfer and left the bus as well, walked over to a Greyhound station that was only a few blocks away, and Oswald asked for a cab. There was a lady who rushed up to Oswald just before he got into the cab, and the lady asked for a cab, and Oswald offered to let the lady take the cab instead of himself. Some people have seen this as evidence that Oswald was not in a hurry and that he was innocent. However, at just that moment, a cab was pulling up behind the cab that Oswald had originally hailed, and Oswald probably thought it was just as easy to let the lady have the first cab and then he would take the second. Instead, the lady, who also saw the cab pulling up, said that she would take the second cab. And so Oswald got into his original cab of choice, the first one, and they set off for Oak Cliff. William Whaley was the cab driver. As Whaley began to cross the Trinity River on the way to Oak Cliff, he wondered why the sirens were blaring all over downtown Dallas. He asked Oswald if he knew, but Oswald said nothing. Whaley decided to ask no more questions, and within just a few minutes, the cab was pulling up at the curb past the boarding house where Oswald lived. Oswald was evidently scoping out the boarding house to make sure there were no police cars there or FBI cars, which would mean that the FBI had gotten the jump on him. Instead, there were no cars there. So Oswald asked the cab driver to let him out a block beyond the boarding house so that the cab driver would not be able to identify the particular house that Oswald was headed for when he dropped him off. Oswald walked back to the boarding house, entered the boarding house in a hurry, according to Mrs. Earlene Roberts, who was tending the house for the landlady at the time. Oswald rushed into his room, refused to answer Mrs. Roberts when she asked him why he was in such a hurry, and within 4 minutes or so, Oswald had emerged from his tiny room with a new jacket on and a gun under his belt. The jacket would then hide the gun. Oswald left the boarding house, was seen for a few seconds at a bus stop adjacent to the boarding house across the street, but then Mrs. Roberts said she did not see Oswald there anymore, and we know that Oswald proceeded to walk in a southerly direction, not far from downtown Oak Cliff, a direction that would take him some points east of Oak Cliff, but to a destination unknown.
Where was Oswald going when he left his boarding house?
at approximately 1:04 p.m.? Well, the short answer is that we don't know, and we will probably never know. Given the small amount of money he had on his person, $13.87, it's pretty clear that Oswald was planning to do something in Dallas, and the speculation is that he may have been trying to make his way to Edwin Walker's house to try to shoot him once again. He started off in an easterly direction from the Beckley house, because we know he encountered Officer J.D. Tippett, which changed everything, some blocks south of Beckley, east of Beckley. And so if Oswald was targeting Edwin Walker, he would have had to go east to pick up a bus that would take him back into the Dallas area and eventually to Walker's house, which was about 5 miles away from Oak Cliff. Now we must enter into a realm of speculation, but informed speculation is better than nothing. We know that Tippett received the description of the gunman at the Texas School Book Depository over the radio, which was transferred from Howard Brennan's description of him. And that description was of a white male, approximately 30, slender build, 5'10", 165 pounds. It wasn't very specific, but it was clearly something that matched Oswald's description. Tippett was ordered into Oak Cliff to look for someone who matched that description. So Tippett was driving east, and when he reached the intersection of 10th and Patton, Tippett could see a man walking towards him down 10th Street. The man was walking in a westerly direction, but was about 2 blocks in front of Tippett. Tippett decided to stop the man. It is possible that when Tippett first saw the man also saw Tippett and turned around abruptly and walked in the opposite direction, that is, in the easterly direction. That would have caught Tippett's eyes and been extremely suspicious. Plus, the man matched the description. So Tippett drove his car and overtook the man and pulled his police car over to the curb. Tippett spoke to the man through the right window, the cozy window, and the man leaned over and put his arms on the car to talk to Tippett from that side of the car, that is, from the sidewalk side. The man was, of course, Lee Harvey Oswald. Oswald and Tippett exchanged some words. The witnesses who saw this exchange said that the exchange seemed to be civil and pleasant, not lasting very long. But whatever Oswald told Tippett did not satisfy Tippett, and so Tippett decided to exit the vehicle, round the front of the car, and speak to Oswald. Tippett did not remove his pistol from his holster, suggesting that he was not terribly suspicious. Of course, we don't have any idea of what the two men said to each other that precipitated Tippett's suspicion, but it appears that the description of Oswald and the fact that he may have turned in his direction was enough for Tippett, who was a fairly savvy police officer who was trained to recognize suspicious movements, had picked up something from Oswald's behavior. Of course, Oswald at that point, as Tippett rounded the corner, shot Tippett 4 times, and then he rounded the back of the car and shot Tippett in the head from behind to make sure that Tippett was dead. Oswald then proceeded to go back in the direction from which Tippett had been driving and to turn south to Jefferson Street at the corner of 10th and Patton. The Davis sisters, who lived in the house at the corner of 10th and Patton, saw him removing his cartridges from his pistol that had been used on Tippett. Oswald then proceeded south towards Jefferson Street. Now, what's interesting about this is primarily the fact that Oswald was walking west on 10th before he turned abruptly after seeing Tippett. This is fascinating because at the time that Oswald was stopped by Tippett, he was still in a section of Oak Cliff that was east of the Beckley house. It was obviously south of the Beckley house, but it was east as well, suggesting that Oswald was initially going in an easterly direction where he could have picked up a bus to a Greyhound station that might have taken him to the border with Mexico, or he could have taken a bus that would have crossed the Trinity River back into the Dallas area and eventually gone to the house of Edwin Walker. That seems to have been the most likely destination for Oswald, according to the newsman Albert Newman. And I think that this is a very plausible speculation. However, it's clear that Oswald must have changed his mind before he encountered Tippit, because although he was moving steadily eastward initially after leaving the Beckley house, he must have changed his direction for some reason, because he was seen walking west on 10th Street when Tippit first saw him, at which time Oswald changed direction, but just for a few steps, until Tippit could stop him. Once Oswald had killed Tippit, he continued his former direction and continued to move west, traveling down Patton Street to Jefferson Avenue, where he was very close to the Texas Theater, where he was eventually arrested. Oswald was seen walking towards the Texas Theater from the east, in a westerly direction, of course, and he was seen hiding in an alcove at Johnny Brewer's shoe store, which was just east of the Texas Theater, just a few stores away. Oswald was then arrested at the Texas Theater. It's very possible that Oswald, when he decided to stop moving east and then started to move in a westerly direction before Tippit encountered him, that Oswald was planning to go to the Texas Theater. The speculation here is that Oswald, as he was moving towards the bus stop, began to get second thoughts on the idea of taking a bus back into Dallas. At this time, which was very shortly after the assassination, when so many police cars were in Dallas, perhaps Oswald remembered how unpleasant it had been to be on the bus on Elm Street, stuck in traffic, when anyone might have searched the bus. Perhaps he thought that buses might be searched in Dallas if he took a bus into Dallas. Clearly, the heat was on, and it may have occurred to Oswald that if he went to the Texas Theater, laid low for a couple of hours, waited until the heat was off of Oak Cliff, he might have a better chance of going to Walker's house at a time when the police traffic in the city might have calmed down. This is purely speculative, but it is obvious that Oswald had remembered his experience on the bus on Elm. He had remembered how many police cars were screaming through the area. He also remembered how maniacal it had made him feel, and indeed look, according to Mary Bledsoe. So Oswald was probably not in a hurry, the more he thought about it, to go back into Dallas, close to where the assassination had happened and where most of the police would be located. Perhaps Oswald also thought that there might be hyped-up security for Edwin Walker in the wake of the assassination, and that the security might have been more relaxed that evening. Certainly, a person moving around in the dark, as Oswald had done following the Walker assassination, was more secure than someone trying to move around the city in the early afternoon. But Oswald must have changed his mind. Otherwise, he would not have moved in an easterly direction at the outset if his destination was west of Beckley. The Texas Theater, where he was arrested, was west of Beckley. When he was walking down 10th Street, he was walking in a westerly direction from some point farther east than the place where Tippit stopped him. So he was considerably farther east when he changed his mind and decided to go west. We know he went east in the first place because that location was considerably east of the Beckley house. So this is a mystery that may never be solved. Why did Oswald first go east before deciding to go west? All of which occurred before he even encountered J.D. Tippit. With the Tippit shooting, Oswald's luck had completely run out. And the rest of the afternoon was going to be very unlucky for Oswald as well. He had no way of knowing that he had been watched as he approached the Texas Theater. But Johnny Brewer in the shoe store noticed that Oswald was huddling in his alcove, looking at the display window with a blank expression, trying to hide his front from the police cars that were screaming past. And when the police cars passed, Oswald turned around and crouched around the entrance to the alcove, looking to see if the police had gone. At that point, he decided to move west towards the Texas Theater. Brewer decided to follow him. Brewer saw Oswald approach the Texas Theater and then rush into the theater when the back of the ticket taker in the ticket booth outside the theater had been turned away from him. Brewer contacted the ticket taker, Julia Postal, and told her that someone had snuck into the theater and had been acting suspiciously outside his shoe store. Julia Postal had been listening to the radio, just as Johnny Brewer had, and they suspected that the man may have been the one who was being sought by the police. So Postal agreed to call the police, while Brewer went to the back of the theater to make sure that nobody exited the theater until the police arrived. When the police arrived, some of the men went to the back of the theater, and some of the police entered the front. Brewer pointed out the location of Oswald in the theater when the lights were turned on. And from that point on, it was a fairly easy matter for the police to approach Oswald, demand that he stand to be searched. Of course, Oswald pulled out a pistol at that point, but he waited until a policeman was actually searching him to pull the pistol out so that the other policeman would not fire a hail of gunshots at him while he was struggling with the policeman. Oswald was heard saying, "Well, it's all over now," before he pointed the pistol in the direction of the policeman, M.A. McDonald, and tried to fire the pistol. But McDonald was able to stop it from firing. Evidently, Oswald was trying to engage in suicide by cop at that point. Oswald had good reason to feel like his plans had been completely destroyed. Now he was a cop killer, and not just a political assassin. Oswald quickly regrouped himself as he was placed in handcuffs and in custody. He was brought into a police car and sent off to Dallas for further interrogation. What happened next further indicates Oswald's plans and also further implicates him. We will look at the interrogation of Oswald that day and the next morning after that, from November 22nd to November 24th, the last hours of Oswald's life, to see what light that sheds on Oswald's plans in the wake of the assassination and if he had survived in the months ahead. Thank you for joining me for this episode, and until our next episode, this is your host, Rick Ryman. Happy listening. That's it for today's episode of AudiblySpeaking.com. New podcast episodes appear on AudiblySpeaking.com approximately once every 2 weeks. Please subscribe to Audibly Speaking on iTunes or whatever podcast aggregator you enjoy. Until next time, this is Rick Ryman. Happy listening!